This content is for institutional investors and information purposes only. It does not contain investment, financial, legal, tax, or any other advice and should not be relied upon for this purpose. The materials are not tailored to your particular personal and/or financial position. If you require advice based on your specific circumstances, you should contact a professional advisor. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers as of the date of publication, are subject to change without notice, and do not necessarily reflect Mercer's opinions.
Hi, welcome to Critical Thinking, Critical Issues. My name is Greg Summer. I lead the U.S. financial intermediary business for Mercer. I'm very happy to be joined by Marika DeRue and Casey Wamsley, very experienced, esteemed colleagues, and we have a very exciting discussion today. We're going to be discussing the topic of the state of alternatives in the wealth management space, which is not only timely, but will be critical over the next decade. There are numerous trends occurring regarding alternative investment vehicles, expansion of alternative asset classes, technological advancements, access to education, investment managers' focus on servicing financial advisors, as well as a dynamic macroeconomic environment that may result in lower returns in traditional investments over the next decade. All of these factors seem to point to accelerating growth in alternative investing amongst financial advisors and increased alternative portfolio allocations. So, Marika, let's begin with a phrase that's in the marketplace, the democratization of private markets. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means to you and what is that, you know, that's being used a lot in the market? Why is it being used a lot? I'm curious to your thoughts.
Yeah, no, thanks, Greg, and delighted to be joining you today. Private markets, ultimately, as we all know, it's fundamentally an illiquid asset class. And as a result, that's only really suitable for investors that can afford to tie their money away for many years. So we would say that the purest way of accessing those private markets is really through closed-ended funds where investors won't have any control over the timing and the capital calls. Now, for a long time, that kind of investing in closed-ended funds came with really high minimums, meaning that it was really only accessible to institutional investors, endowments, large family offices. What has essentially happened and what that democratization refers to some extent is that there have been a lot more changes in regulatory environment, new fintech platforms that have allowed smaller amounts, smaller ticket sizes come into such close-ended private market structures. So from that point of view, we call it democratization because effectively lower tickets and as a result, investors with lower investable assets than the classic investor can now access the asset class. Now, clearly, the investment threshold is still relatively high and maybe clients still would need to have quite a few million to invest overall, of which a percentage can then come into private markets. So we can call it democratization, but I guess it is still an asset class that is for those clients that really have that illiquid appetite and can invest for such a long time horizon, which sometimes can be all the way up to 10 years.
Do you think, Marika, that this trend is going to continue? Have we seen an acceleration into certain types of vehicles or things that are being created for this wealth management space?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say the fintech platforms, the changes in regulation that is allowing now ticket sizes are of as low as 100,000 into private markets are clearly accelerating that. Those flows going into private markets. But alongside it, and that will be an interesting topic to discuss on this podcast as well, is an increased offer of what we're called semi-liquid private market solutions. And those are all sorts of names, LTIFs, LTAFs in Europe. Casey probably can refer to what they call in the US. But that is all ultimately kind of getting a bit of a slice of the pie in private markets. There's pros and cons of both routes. But yes, we foresee an ever-increasing growth. And exactly to your opening point, that there is that appetite for those higher returns. And if you lock your money away for longer, you're probably more likely to get that.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Casey, I know sometimes you take a macro or big picture look to the calendar years and thing trends that might be happening. Do you have any thoughts about 2024?
Certainly, Greg. 2024 is the year of the dragon, as many of you have heard. In some cultures, the dragon represents chaos, evil, volatility, fire. But in other cultures, it means strength, hidden wisdom, guidance. And with all the different things going on in the volatile markets around the world, I think it's up to us as being stewards of capital, whether we are being stewards of institutional capital, private client capital, working with private market managers or other alternative managers. All of us collectively need to be thinking about our kind of education, our strength, our wisdom, and guiding clients as we look out into 2024 and beyond with the volatility in these markets. And so that's what I would say for this year, the year of the dragon, is really being steadfast and making sure that we're doing things correctly, properly, and education for us.
Excellent. So if we take that down a couple levels, tell us about the types of clients you serve within the wealth management space and how they approach investing in alternatives.
Certainly. So there's a number of different types of clients that we serve within the financial intermediary space. I'll give you a few examples. Registered investment advisor firms who are serving private clients and institutional clients. We work with multifamily offices. We work with bank wealth platforms and their research teams to help them think about portfolio construction, manager selection, investment manager due diligence, operational manager due diligence, capital pacing and implementation, and vehicle selection. There's a lot of different pieces of the building blocks that we need to consider in working with our different types of clients. So, Greg, I would say two things. One, there's different types of clients. Then there's also clients that are in different stages of their alternative journey, if you will. So that really guides us on how we're going to work with those clients when we're helping them establish the building blocks they need to have a successful alternative program.
Interested. So, Marika, what have you seen as some of the common practices that can support these wealth managers, some of the things that Casey was starting to get at? How are they best supported and how are they best implemented?
Yeah, I think Casey made the right points there. I guess a successful program, it's we see it often as a journey. And you're right, there's all sorts of types of firms with more or less in-house resources. But to kind of make it a successful journey, initially the starting point will obviously be what will ultimately the clients of that wealth management firm. What are they most suitable for and what type of clients do they have? Is it discretionary? Is it advisory? And then the next stage would be how big an allocation? What can be the percentage of their overall investable assets? Kind of ties in with what we talked about earlier, that threshold, that tier is coming down rapidly. But then once they've decided how much they can kind of earmark for private markets, then it's really a question about which asset classes within. I mean, historically, of course, a lot of noise about private equity, a lot of demand, and I guess people being attracted by those higher double-digit returns. But what we see now is that alongside private equity, there are other emerging asset classes, not emerging, there have been well-established asset classes now, like private debt, like private infrastructure, real assets. And Once the client has decided, or maybe a combination of those asset classes for different return drivers, then it's a question of how much diversification with it, how many GPs, how to build up that exposure over time. And then we come to some of the point Casey just referred to. What about due diligence? What about sourcing? What about access? What about capacity? And then how do you monitor such a program? So the journey is, to some extent, has many phases, and that comes with quite a complex overall kind of design process. Now, one question we get asked, and it will be interesting to see if you get the same asked in the US, ultimately, we get asked the question, if I lock my capital up for 10 years, and I did that in a private equity or let's say private debt instrument versus a liquid instrument after 10 years with all the fees, will I be better off? And our answer is, you're absolutely better off if you pick the right GP. However, if you don't, because the dispersion is much, much wider between GPs than in the public side, then can clearly be worse off. And that's why it's so important to do that groundwork and that due diligence and that sourcing, and make sure you pick the right funds, because once you're in, you're in for quite a long time.
So let me just emphasize those last points. I think they're critical. While we're all speaking about access to these alternative investments that the wealth management space may have not had historically, that institutions did, the ability to do it in an institutional, professional manner is critical. And the opportunities are immense. But to your point, Marika, you need to be identifying that top quartile, top two quartiles to be successful. So Casey, do you want to talk a little bit, even in more depth, about the due diligence process, about the manager selection process, not only the importance of it, but how it might be implemented at an advisor?
Sure. Greg, maybe I'll start with some investment due diligence comments and thoughts, and maybe throw it back to you to comment on some of the operational due diligence expertise there. So from an investment due diligence perspective, the private market alternative due diligence is a lot different than obviously traditional managers and even that of hedge funds. There's a lot of moving pieces and parts, liquidity profiles, underlying portfolio companies. Think about when we're doing reference checks within a private equity manager, we're actually reaching out to underlying portfolio companies that these private equity firms have worked with, spoken with their executive management teams about what those relationships are like, in some of the companies that they've sold even out of their portfolio. And getting private market data performance and using public market equivalents, there's a lot of different issues when you're trying to tie the pieces together and doing investment due diligence in the private markets. And so within private equity, even you have multiple different verticals. And then if you switch over to private credit, for example, there's different verticals in there. So you have to have very specialized teams that know the individual asset classes to do the proper investment due diligence.
How does an advisory firm do that? Let's take two examples, a small one or a large one. How might they approach that? Is it done internally? Do they have external parties doing it? Do you need individuals with expertise in each asset class? How might they think about it?
Right. Well, Marika already talked about the dispersion of GPs. And if you pick the wrong GP, you're stuck in that wrong GP for a very long time. Typically, what we see in the wealth management space, most of these teams aren't large enough to have specialized research individuals in the different asset classes. So they're typically partnering with outside resources to help them with both investment due diligence and operational due diligence, really as an extension of their process in making sure they're documenting and the way they're sourcing and doing their due diligence.
Sure. So I'll just briefly, you set me up on the operational due diligence side. Just want to emphasize once again, since alternative investing is more complex than buying public organizations, not only understanding the investment thesis, but understanding the organization itself. And when we say operational due diligence, it might really be referring to organizational due diligence, understanding the governance, the leadership, the technology, and the ability to implement the investment strategy is of equal importance, not only from a red flag or large loss perspective, but for performance itself. So understanding how those tie together, I think, is important from an advisor perspective. Let's touch, Marika, you started talking about the different asset classes a little bit. So I tend to like to look forward when we think about investing. People, I think, sometimes look backward, but I want to create a parallel. I always thought that after the global financial crisis, a huge opportunity was created in the private credit space. Because what happened was commercial banking and traditional lending sources did not come back into the market the way they had before the crisis, and it created a void and a huge opportunity for private credit. As we look forward, it seems to me that infrastructure is an asset class that's going to have struggles for public funding because the governments around the world have had created so much debt that they'll be restricted on their source of funds. And the need in the U.S. and globally for infrastructure building for developed countries and emerging countries will be immense. So it seems like a very large opportunity as an example. Can you think of other opportunities, either infrastructure, private credit, private equity, real estate, how you might think of how an advisor might think they might fit into portfolios for their clients?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I would start off with what you said there about infrastructure. Sometimes when we mention infrastructure to clients, they perceive that as being roads, bridges. Now, of course, that is required too, but it may be not quite racy enough in terms of performance or not quite exciting enough in terms of for opportunity set, regardless of the inflation hedge that it can obviously provide. But what we see a lot now is that to, for example, support the whole energy transition, to build out all the charging points, the solar panels, etc., across on a huge scale, there is a lot of infrastructure projects that are or private infrastructure opportunities that we see that are very well aligned with what private clients would like to support, invest in, interesting return profile, etc. And the same probably goes to your earlier point about private debt, where there was such a void that was then fulfilled by private lending, direct lending. That's become a huge, huge market. Now, I would even go one step further. We talk a lot about closed-ended solutions, and that, yes, absolutely, that would probably be the purest form of getting exposure. But what we see now, semi-liquid solutions in particular for private debt lends itself really, really well, where the complexity of the capital calls the distributions is sometimes somewhat complex with closed-ended funds. Actually, it lends itself very well for semi-liquid, where people like a bit of liquidity, and that income stream that can come from direct lending is then kind of mitigating. Yes, you have a bit of cash drag and you'll have to give up a little bit of performance, but it's a good medium ground to get exposure to a private market asset class, say direct lending or private debt, yet you're not fully locking your money away. So I think those two, real estate, of course, always there. Although we see, especially in the private wealth side, many clients have real estate. So they have their house, they have their real estate, they don't want to top it up again in a private wealth portfolio. So I would say probably a little bit less demand for that than private debt, PE, and infrastructure.
That makes perfect sense. Casey, let's shift for a moment. So I've had conversations with advisors who are a little skeptical about putting alternatives into their clients' portfolios. And they say, hey, there's been multiple fits and starts through the years where everybody said alternatives would become more accepted in the advisor space, and there was a lot of resistance. I would state that as advisors, as the generational wealth transfer happens, and there are more open attitudes towards alternatives, as well as the fact of technology, and maybe most importantly, Casey, education comes into play, right? Nobody's going to invest in something they don't understand, or something that seems mysterious or high risk. What do you think about education and where we are in that process and where we might improve that or how that's going to accelerate going forward?
Certainly. So education seems to be one of the hardest things to to bridge as far as in gaps between an investment team to an investment advisor to the end client. And because we have these double gaps in education, I think it's all of our jobs. I mentioned this earlier as good stewards of capital, to make sure that we're thinking about good educational programs for everybody to understand, all the way from the investment team, the investment committee, investment advisor, and down to the client, from that perspective. So there's a number of different areas there. And what I find most interesting in our industry, I've been in the industry for about 30 years, and still today, it surprises me how the most sophisticated investment groups are still made up of individuals who then have all the behavioral biases as a retail investor, right? Charles Ellis wrote a really interesting paper called Murder on the Orient Express, and it was published in the CFA realm, and it talked about bad performance and who done it. That's what he said, who done it, right? And it talks about, it's the chief investment officers, it's the investment advisors, and it's actually the end clients too. They're all chasing returns. So Greg, you asked about fits and starts. Think about during the financial crisis, right? At GFC, CTAs perform really well, right? Managed futures. So everyone piled into that at the top, right? And, the hedge funds, the whole thing, right, is just kind of rinse and repeat. It happens on the traditional side of the book as well. It's very common in the industry to sell a manager when they're down and go hire a manager that's been outperforming, and it's rinse and repeat. So I think as we're trying to put together thoughtful alternative investment programs, having that good governance process combined with education is super important.
Yeah, I don't think that can, that can never be overemphasized. It's just so important. I agree. So, Marika, let me ask you a different question. The title of this podcast is Alternatives. We've been very focused on illiquid or private market investments. Let's just take a moment or two and talk about hedge funds. Hedge funds were once the darling, and they've gone a little bit in the other direction. Is it time to reconsider that thought process and to bring them more significant into portfolios? And where do they fit into the next decade as far as investing?
Yeah, no, great question, Greg. So I would say, at least as if we talk for Europe, we definitely have seen a decent demand for hedge funds, but maybe playing a different role than what Casey was just performing. So not so much chasing the performance, but really as a diversifier alongside an equity and fixed income. So diversified to equity beta, let's say. Now, clearly on the back of 2022, 2023, they finally maybe did what they were supposed to do all along. As a result, there is now an increased kind of a bit of a comeback. Maybe they were never gone for some people, but I would say we see demand to play that role, to build a diversified cash plus 3-4% a block that can then sit alongside in a discretionary portfolio across equity and hedge. And then we're talking really more liquid side. So there's probably been a bit of a subtle shift away from more protective areas, still to some return seeking, but doing that through a diversified return. So we particularly see interest in credit, multi-strat to some extent, fixed income relative value. So yeah, but I fully agree with Casey's point earlier, right? I mean, due diligence, ODD, IDD is absolutely key to make sure your hedge fund program is solid, governance is tight, and you back the right hedge funds, because again, it is probably, compared to private markets, still perceived as somewhat more complex, somewhat more black box, somewhat more star leaders, star fund managers running it, and not everybody really understanding it as well as they should.
So true. And I would just add that, just like on the private market, the identification of the high performing managers is critical. You can't look at a hedge fund median return. You have to be identifying the top performers. And the last point I'd make on that is, we think of hedge funds as an asset class, but hedge funds are a structure. And there's just, you named some of the key strategies within hedge funds, Marika, but they're so diverse and they can actually be used and serve different purposes. So a lot of great information, Casey and Marika. That was a wonderful discussion. If I were to very quickly try to sum it up, I would say that over the next decade and more, even more quickly within that decade, and for the current and next generation, alternative investing may become a standard investment allocation, no different than public equities. The ease of the investment process, access to education and trusted partners, and the opportunity to present itself within the wealth management space, the way it's been used within the institutional space for decades, is really, really being presented now today. So I think it's a very exciting time for everybody to become much more knowledgeable and gain education in this space. So Marika and Casey, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I very much enjoyed discussion, and I'm sure our listeners will find it quite informative. So thanks everyone for listening. If you like this content and you want to hear more, please subscribe and leave a review and discuss anything we've talked about in today's episode further. Feel free to reach out to your local Mercer representative, and we'd be happy to speak with you about it. Thanks again.